Name meet, he said softly in English.
Mackenzie, J.W., the young man said, shoulders straightening as he drew himself up, sharp chin jutting. Lieutenant, Royal Air Force, service number...
He broke off, staring at Roger, who belatedly realized that, calmless or no, he was grinning from ear to ear.
What's funny? Jerry Mackenzie demanded, belligerent.
Nothing,
Roger assured him.
Glad to see you, that's all.
His throat was tight, and he had to cough.
Have you been here long?
No, just a few hours. You wouldn't have any food on you, I don't suppose.
He looked hopefully from one man to the other.
We do, Buck said, but this is another time to stop for a bite, aye?
He glanced over his shoulder.
Let's be off.
Aye, we should.
But Roger spoke automatically, unable to stop looking at J.W. Mackenzie, RAF, aged 22.
Who are you?
Jerry asked, staring back.
Where'd you come from? God knows you're not from here.
Roger exchanged a quick look with Buck. They hadn't planned what to say. Roger hadn't been willing to jinx the Enterprise by thinking that they'd really find Jerry Mackenzie, and as for Buck...
Inverness,
Buck said abruptly. He sounded gruff. Jerry's eyes flicked back and forth between them, and he caught Roger's sleeve.
You know what I mean, he said, ungulped air, bracing himself. When?
Roger touched Jerry's hand, cold and dirty, the fingers long like his own. The question caught at his throat and thickened his voice too much to speak.
Long way from you, Buck said quietly.
And for the first time, Roger caught a note of desolation in his voice.
From now? Lost.
That struck him to the heart. He'd truly forgotten their situation for a little, driven by the urgency of finding this man. But Buck's answer made Jerry's face, already drawn with hunger and strain, go white under the dirt.
Jesus, Jerry whispered. Where are we now? And when?
Buck stiffened, not at Jerry's question, but at a noise from outside. Roger didn't know what had made it, but it wasn't the wind. Buck made a low, urgent noise in his throat, shifting.
I think it's part of Northumbria now, Roger said. Look, there's no time. We have to go before someone hears.
Aye, right. Let's go then.
Jerry had a filthy silk scarf round his neck. He tugged the ends straight and shoved them into his shirt. The air outside was wonderful after the smells of the cow byre, fresh with new-turned earth and dying heather. They made their way as quickly as they could through the yard, skirting the farmhouse. Jerry was lame, he saw, limping badly, and Roger took his arm to help. A shrill yap came from the darkness some distance away, then another bark, in a deeper tone. Roger hastily licked a finger and held it up to gauge the direction of the breeze. A dog barked, and another echoed it.
This way,
he whispered to his companions, tugging Jerry's arm. He led them away from the house as fast as possible, trying to keep his bearings, and they found themselves stumbling through a ploughed field, dirt clods crumbling under their boots. Buck stumbled and swore under his breath. They lurched from furrow to ridge, half-legged and clumsy, Roger clinging to Jerry's arm to keep him upright. One of Jerry's legs seemed gammy and wouldn't take his weight.
He's been wounded. I saw the medal.
Then the dogs began to bark, voices suddenly clear and much closer.
Jesus!
Roger stopped for an instant, breathing hard. Where the bloody hell was the wood they'd hidden in? He'd swear they'd been heading for it. But the beam from the lantern swung crazily, showing meaningless patches of field. He shut the slide. They'd be better off without it.
This way.
Buck lurched away, and Roger and Jerry followed perforce, hearts thumping.
Christ, it sounded like a half a dozen dogs at least had been let loose, all barking.
And was that a voice calling to the dogs?
Yes, it bloody was.
He couldn't understand a word, but the meaning was as clear as ice water. They ran, stumbling and panting. Roger couldn't tell where they were. He was following Buck. He dropped the lantern at one point. It fell over with a clank, and he heard the oil inside gurgle out of its reservoir. With a soft whoosh, it flowered into brilliant flame. Shit! They ran. It didn't matter where, what direction, just away from the burning beacon and the irate voices. More than one now. Suddenly they were in a scrim of trees, the low, wind-crabbed grove they'd lurked in earlier. But the dogs were on their track, barking eagerly, and they didn't linger, but fought their way through the brush and out again, up a steep hill turfed with heather. Roger's foot sank through the spongy growth into a puddle, soaking him to the ankle, and he nearly lost his balance. Jerry set his feet and yanked Roger upright, then lost his own balance when his knee gave way. They clung together, wobbling precariously for an instant. Then Roger lurched forward again, and they were out of it. He thought his lungs would burst, but they kept going, not running any longer. You couldn't run up a hill like this. Slogging, planting one foot after another, after another. Roger began to see bursts of light at the edges of his vision. He tripped, staggered, and fell, and was hauled to his feet by Jerry. They were all three half-sopping and smeared head to toe with mud and heather scratchings, when they lurched at last to the crest of the hill and stopped for a moment, swaying and gasping for air.
"Where are we going?"
Jerry wheezed, using the end of his scarf to wipe his face. Roger shook his head, still short of breath, but then caught the faint gleam of water.
"We're taking you back to the stones by the lake, where you came through. Come on."
They pelted down the far side of the hill, headlong, almost falling, now exhilarated by the speed and the thought of a goal.
"How did you find me?"
Jerry gasped, when at last they hit bottom and stopped for breath.
"Found your tags," Buck said, almost brusque. "Followed the trail back."
Roger put a hand to his pocket, about to offer them back, but didn't. It had struck him, like a stone to the middle of his chest, that having found Jerry Mackenzie against substantial odds, he was about to part from him, likely forever. And that was only if things went well. His father. Dad? He couldn't think of this young man, white-faced and lame, nearly 20 years his junior, as his father. Not the father he'd imagined all his life.
"Come on."
Buck took Jerry's arm now, nearly holding him up, and they began to forge their way across the dark fields, losing their way and finding it again, guided by the light of Orion overhead. Orion, Lepus, Canis Major. He found a measure of comfort in the stars blazing in the cold black sky. Those didn't change. They'd shine forever, or as close as made no difference, on him and on this man, no matter where each one might end up.
End up.
The cold air burned in his lungs.
Bree.
And then he could see them. Squatty pillars, no more than blotches on the night, visible only because they showed dark and immobile against the sheet of moving water stirred by the wind.
"Right,"
he said hoarsely, and swallowing, wiped his face on his sleeve.
"This is where we leave you."
"You do," Jerry panted,
but you... When you came through, did you have anything on you? A gemstone? Any jewellery?"
"Aye," Jerry said, bewildered.
"I had a raw sapphire in my pocket, but it's gone. It's like it burned up."
Buck finished for him, grim-voiced.
"Aye. Well, so?"
This last was clearly addressed to Roger, who hesitated.
"Bree."
No more than an instant, though. He stuck a hand into the leather pouch at his waist, pulled out the tiny oilcloth package, fumbled it open, and pressed the garnet pendant into Jerry's hand. It was faintly warm from his body, and Jerry's cold hand closed over it in reflex.
"Take this. It's a good one."
When you go through, Roger said, and leaned toward him, trying to impress him with the importance of his instructions.
Think about your wife, about Marjorie. Think hard.
See her in your mind's eye and walk straight through.
Whatever the hell you do, though, don't think about your son. Just your wife.
What? Jerry was gobsmacked. How the bloody hell do you know my wife's name? And where have you heard about my son?
It doesn't matter, Roger said,
and turned his head to look back over his shoulder.
Damn, said Buck softly. They're still coming. There's a light.
There was a single light, bobbing evenly over the ground, as it would if someone carried it. But look as he might, Roger could see no one behind it, and a violent shiver ran over him.
Deutsche,
said Buck, under his breath. Roger knew that word well enough. Spirit, it meant. And usually an ill-disposed one. A haunt.
Aye, maybe.
He was beginning to catch his breath.
And maybe not.
He turned again to Jerry.
Either way, you need to go, man. And now, remember, think of your wife.
Jerry swallowed, his hand closing tight around the stone.
Aye, right. Thanks, then, he added awkwardly.
Roger couldn't speak, could give him nothing more than the breath of a smile. Then Buck was beside him, plucking urgently at his sleeve and gesturing at the bobbing light, and they set off, awkward and lumbering after the brief cool-down.
Bree.
He swallowed, fists clenched.
He'd got a stone once, he could do it again.
But the greater part of his mind was still with the man they'd just left by the lake. He looked over his shoulder and saw Jerry beginning to walk, limping badly but resolute, thin shoulders squared under his pale khaki shirt, and the end of his scarf fluttering in the rising wind. Then it all rose up in him. Seized by an urgency greater than any he'd ever known, he turned and ran. Ran, heedless of footing, of dark, of Buck's startled cry behind him. Jerry heard his footsteps on the grass and whirled round, startled himself. Roger grabbed him by both hands, squeezed them hard enough to make Jerry gasp, and said fiercely,
I love you.
That was all there was time for, and all he could possibly say. He let go and turned away fast, his boots making a shoof-shoof noise in the dry lake grass. He glanced up at the hill, but the light had vanished. Likely it had been someone from the farmhouse, satisfied now that the intruders were gone. Buck was waiting, shrouded in his cloak and holding Roger's. He must have dropped it coming down the hill. Buck shook it out and folded it round Roger's shoulders. Roger's fingers shook, trying to fasten the brooch.
Why did you tell him a daft thing like that? Buck asked, doing it for him.
Buck's head was bent, not looking at him. Roger swallowed hard, and his voice came clear but painful, the words like ice shards in his throat.
Because he isn't going to make it back. It's the only chance I'll ever have. Come on.
Chapter 102. Postpartum. The night shivered. The whole night. The ground and the lake, the sky, the dark, the stars, and every particle of his own body. He was scattered instantly everywhere and part of everything. And part of them. There was one moment of an exaltation too great for fear, and then he vanished. His last thought no more than a faint, I am, voiced more in hope than declaration. Roger came back to a blurred knowledge of himself, flat on his back under a clear black sky, whose brilliant stars seemed pinpoints now, desperately far away. He missed them, missed being part of the night, missed with a brief rending sense of desolation,
the two men who'd shared his soul for that blazing moment. The sound of Buck throwing up returned him to a sense of his body. He was lying in cold, wet grass, half-soaked, smelling of mud and old manure, chilled to the bone, and bruised in a number of uncomfortable places. Buck said something horrible in Gaelic and retched again. He was on his hands and knees a few feet away, a blot on the darkness.
"You all right?"
Roger croaked, rolling onto his side. He'd remembered suddenly the trouble with Buck's heart when they'd made their passage at Craignadun.
"If your heart's giving you bother again."
"If it was, damn all you could do about it, is there?" Buck said.
He hawked a glob of something nasty into the grass and sat down heavily, wiping his sleeve across his mouth.
"Christ, I hate that. Dinna ken we'd feel it this far away."
"Mm-hmm."
Roger sat up slowly. He wondered whether Buck had felt the same thing he had, but it didn't seem the moment for metaphysical discussion.
"He's gone, then?"
"Want me to go and make sure of it?"
Buck said disagreeably.
"God, my head."
Roger rose to his feet, staggering a little, and went and got Buck under one arm, levering him to his feet.
"Come on," he said. "Let's go find the horses. We'll get away a bit, make a wee camp, get some food into you."
"I'm not hungry."
"I bloody am."
In fact, he was ravenous. Buck swayed, but appeared able to stand on his own. Roger released him and turned briefly to look back at the distant lake and the standing stones. For an instant, he recaptured the sense of being part of them. And then it was gone. The gleaming water and the stones were no more than part of the craggy landscape. There was no way of knowing what time it was, but the night was still pitch dark by the time they'd retrieved the horses, made their way to a sheltered spot under a cliff face, found water, made fire, and toasted some bannocks to eat with their dried salt herring. They didn't talk, both exhausted. Roger pushed away the obvious,
"So now what?"
and let his thoughts come randomly as they would. Time enough for plans tomorrow. After a bit, Buck got up abruptly and went off into the dark. He stayed gone for some time, during which time Roger sat gazing into the fire, replaying every moment he'd spent with Jerry Mackenzie in his mind, trying to fix it all. He wished passionately that it had been daylight, that he'd been able to see more of his father's face than the brief glimpses he'd had in the beam of the dark lantern. Whatever his regrets, though, and the cold knowledge that Jerry wouldn't make it back, or not back to where he'd started from, at least.
God, what if he ended up lost in yet another strange time? Was that possible?
There was the one small, warm thing. He'd said it. And wherever his father had gone, he'd carry that with him. He wrapped himself in his cloak, lay down by the embers of the fire, and carried it with him into sleep. When Roger woke in the morning, thick-headed but feeling reasonably okay, Buck had already built up the fire and was frying bacon. The smell of it got Roger into a sitting position, rubbing the last of the sleep from his eyes. Buck blotted a slice of thick bacon out of the pan with a bannock and handed it to him. He seemed to have recovered from the after-effects of Jerry's leaving. He was dishevelled and unshaven, but clear-eyed, and gave Roger an assessing look.
"Are you in one piece?"
It wasn't asked as a rhetorical question, and Roger nodded, taking the food. He started to say something in reply, but his throat was constricted, and nothing much came out. He cleared his throat hard, but Buck shook his head, indicating that no effort need be made on his part.
"I'm thinking we'll head north again," Buck said without preamble. "You'll want to keep looking for your lad, I suppose. But I want to go to Cranesmuir."
So did Roger, though likely for other reasons. He eyed Buck closely, but his ancestor avoided his eye.
"Keyless Duncan,
wouldn't you?"
Buck's tone was belligerent.
"I just did,"
Roger said dryly.
"Aye, of course you do."
This didn't come as a surprise. He chewed his makeshift butty slowly, wondering just how much to tell Buck about Gilles.
"Your mother," he began, and cleared his throat again.
When Roger had finished, Buck sat in silence for some time, blinking at the last slice of bacon, drying in the pan.
"Jesus," he said,
but not in tones of shock. More a deep interest, Roger thought, with some unease. Buck glanced up at Roger, speculation in his moss-green eyes.
"And what you ken about my father, then?"
"More than I can tell you in a few minutes, and we should be on our way."
Roger got up, brushing crumbs off his knees.
"I don't want to try explaining our presence to any of those hairy buggers. My old English isn't what it used to be."
"Sumer is a coomin' in,"
Buck said, with a glance at the leafless, wind-blasted saplings precariously rooted in the cliff's crevices.
"Luda sing cuckoo?"
"Aye, let's go."
Chapter 103. Solstice. December the 19th, 1980. Edinburgh, Scotland. A Practical Guide for Time Travellers. Part 2. It's almost time. The winter solstice is day after tomorrow. I keep imagining that I can feel the earth shifting slowly in the dark tectonic plates moving under my feet, and things, invisibly, lining up. The moon is waxing, nearly a quarter full. Have no idea whether that might be important. In the morning, we'll take the train to Inverness. I've called Fiona. She'll meet us at the station, and we'll eat and change at her house. Then she'll drive us to Craignadun and leave us there. Keep wondering if I should ask her to stay, or at least to come back in an hour, in case one or more of us should still be there, on fire or unconscious. Or dead. After dithering for an hour, I called Lionel Mingus, too, and asked him to keep an eye on Rob Cameron. Inverness is a small town. There's always the chance that someone will see us coming off the train, or at Fiona's. And word spreads fast. If anything's going to happen, I want warning. I have these brief lucid moments when everything seems okay, and I'm filled with hope, almost trembling with anticipation. Most of the time I keep thinking I'm insane, and then I'm really shaking. Chapter 104. The Succubus of Cranesmuir. Cranesmuir, Scotland. Roger and Buck stood at the far side of the tiny square in the middle of Cranesmuir, looking up at the fiscal's house. Roger cast a bleak look at the plinth in the middle of the square, with its wooden pillory. At least there were holes for only one miscreant. No crime waves in Cranesmuir.
"The attic, you said?"
Buck was staring intently at the windows of the top story. It was a substantial house, with leaded windows, and even the attic had some, though smaller than the ones in the lower stories.
"I can see plants hanging from the ceiling, I think."
"That's what Claire said, aye.
That she keeps her... The word lair came to mind, but he discarded this in favour of
her surgery up there,
where she makes up her potions and charms.
He inspected his cuffs, which were still damp after a hasty sponge bath at the village horse trough to remove the worst stains of travel, and checked to see that his hair ribbon was in order. The door opened, and a man came out. A merchant, maybe, or a lawyer, well-dressed, with a warm coat against the mizzle. Buck shifted to one side, peering to get a look before the door closed behind him.
"There's a servant at the door," he reported. "I'll knock, then, and ask if I can see Mrs. Duncan. Is that her name?"
"For the moment, aye,"
Roger said. He sympathised entirely with Buck's need to see his mother.
And in all truth, he was curious to meet the woman himself. She was his five times great-grandmother, and one of the few time travellers he knew about.
but he'd also heard enough about her that his feelings were of excitement mixed with considerable unease. He coughed, fist to his mouth.
Do you want me to come up with you?
If she's to home, I mean.
Buck opened his mouth to reply, then closed it, considered a moment, then nodded.
Aye, I do, he said quietly.
He shot Roger a sidelong look, though, with a gleam of humour in it.
You can help keep the conversation going.
Happy to help, Roger said.
We're agreed, though. You didn't mean to tell her who you are.
Or what?
Buck nodded again, though his eyes were now fixed on the door, and Roger thought he wasn't attending.
Aye, he said. Come on, then.
And strode across the square, head up and shoulders squared.
Mrs. Duncan, well, I dinna ken, gentlemen, the maid said. She's to hame the day, but Dr. McEwen's with her just noo.
Roger's heart jumped.
Is she ill?
Buck asked sharply, and the maid blinked, surprised.
Och, no, they're taking tea in the parlour. Would you like to step in, Utherine, and I'll go and see what she says?
She stepped back to let them in, and Roger took advantage of this to touch her arm.
Dr. McEwen's a friend of ours. Would you maybe be giving him our names? Roger and William Mackenzie, at his service.
They discreetly shook as much water as possible off their hats and coats, but within a few moments the maid was back, smiling.
Come up, gentlemen, Mrs. Duncan says, and welcome. Just up the stair there. I'll be fetching ye a bit of tea.
The parlour was one floor above, a small room, rather crowded, but warm and colourful. Neither of the men had eyes for the furnishings, though.
Mr. Mackenzie,
Dr. McEwen said, looking surprised but cordial.
And Mr. Mackenzie.
He shook hands with them and turned to the woman who had risen from her seat beside the fire.
My dear, allow me to make you acquainted with an erstwhile patient of mine and his kinsman. Gentlemen, Mrs. Duncan.
Roger felt Buck stiffen slightly, and no wonder. He hoped he wasn't staring himself. Gillis Duncan was maybe not a classic beauty, but that didn't matter. She was certainly good-looking, with creamy blonde hair put up under a lace cap, and, of course, the eyes. Eyes that made him want to close his own and poke Buck in the back to make him do the same, because surely she or McEwen would notice. McEwen had noticed something, all right, but it wasn't the eyes. He was eyeing Buck with a small frown of displeasure as Buck took a long stride forward, seized the woman's hand, and boldly kissed it.
Mrs. Duncan, he said, straightening up and smiling right into those clear green eyes. Your most humble and obedient servant, ma'am.
She smiled back, one blonde brow raised with an amused look that met Buck's implied challenge, and raised it. Even from where he was standing, Roger felt the snap of attraction between them, sharp as a spark of static electricity. So had McEwen.
How is your health, Mr. Mackenzie?
McEwen said pointedly to Buck. He pulled a chair into place.
Do sit down and let me examine you.
Buck either didn't hear or pretended not to. He was still holding Gillis Duncan's hand and she wasn't pulling it away.
"'Twas kind of you to receive us, ma'am,' he said, "'and certainly we don't mean to disturb your tea. "'We'd heard of your skill as a healer, "'and meant to call in what you might say is a professional way.'
"'Professional?' she repeated,
"'and Roger was surprised at her voice. "'It was light, almost girlish. "'Then she smiled again, and the illusion of girlishness vanished.' She drew her hand away now, but with a languid air of reluctance, her eyes still fixed on Buck with obvious interest.
Your profession or mine?
Ah, I'm not but a humble solicitor, ma'am, Buck said with a gravity so patently mock that Roger wanted to punch him.
Then he added, turning to Roger,
and my kinsman here is a scholar and musician. But as you see, he suffered a sad accident to his throat and... Now Roger truly wanted to punch him.
Aye,
he began, but with the cruel whim of fate, his throat chose that moment to constrict, and his protest ended in a gurgle like a rusty pipe.
"We'd heard of you, mistress, as I said,"
Buck went on, putting a sympathetic hand on Roger's shoulder and squeezing hard.
"And as I say, we wondered..."
"Let me see," she said, and came to stand in front of Roger, her face suddenly a few inches from his. Behind her, McEwen was growing red in the face.
"I've seen this man," he told her. "It's a permanent injury, though I was able to offer some small relief, but..."
"Permanent indeed." She'd undone his neckcloth in seconds and spread his shirt open, her fingers warm and light on his scar. She shifted her gaze and looked directly into his eyes. "But a lucky one, I'd say. You didn't die."
"No,"
he said, his voice hoarse but at least serviceable again.
"I didn't."
God, she was unsettling. Claire had described her vividly. But Claire was a woman. She was still touching him, and while her touch was not in any way improper, it was damned intimate. Buck was growing restive. He didn't like her touching Roger any more than McEwen did. He cleared his throat.
"I wonder, mistress, might you have any simples, medicines perhaps? Not only for my kinsman here, but... well..."
He coughed in a way meant to indicate that he harboured more delicate ailments that he didn't wish to mention before others. The woman smelled of sex. Very recent sex. It rose from her like incense. She stayed in front of Roger for a moment, still looking intently into his face, but then smiled and took her hand away, leaving his throat feeling suddenly cool and exposed. "Of course," she said, switching smile and attention to Buck. "Come up to my wee attic, sir. I'm sure I've something there that will cure what ails you." Roger felt goose flesh ripple across his chest and shoulders, in spite of the good fire on the hearth. Buck and McEwen had both twitched slightly, and she bloody well knew it, though her face was entirely composed. Roger fixed a glare on Buck, willing his ancestor to look at him. Buck didn't, but moved to take Gilles's arm, pulling her hand through his elbow. A slow, hot flush burned up the back of his neck. McEwen made a very small noise in his throat. Then Buck and Gilles were gone, the sound of their footsteps and animated voices dying away as they climbed the stairs to the attic, leaving Roger and McEwen both silent, each for his own reasons. Roger thought that the good doctor might be about to suffer an apoplexy, if that was the correct medical term for blow a gasket. Whatever his own feelings about the abrupt departure of Buck and Gilles, and those were vivid, they paled beside the hue of Hector McEwen's face. The doctor was panting slightly, his complexion puce. Plainly he wanted to follow the errant pair, but just as clearly was constrained by the fact that he had no idea what he might conceivably do when he caught up with them.
"It's not what you think," Roger said, commending his soul to God and hoping that it wasn't.
McEwen swung round to glare at him.
"The devil it's not," he snapped. "You don't know her." "Plainly not as well as you do, no,"
Roger said pointedly, and raised one brow. McEwen said something blasphemous in reply, took up the poker, and stabbed viciously at the smoking bricks of peat in the hearth. He half turned toward the door, the poker still in his hand, and the look on his face was such that Roger leapt to his feet and grabbed him by the arm.
"Stop, man,"
he said, keeping his voice pitched as low and evenly as he could, in hopes of soothing McEwen.
"You'll do yourself no good. Sit down now. I'll tell you why it... why he... why the man's interested in her. For the same reason every dog in the village is interested in a bitch in heat,"
McEwen said venomously. But he let Roger take the poker from his hand, and while he wouldn't sit down, he did at least take several deep breaths that restored a semblance of calm.
Aye. Tell me then, for all the good it will do, he said.
It wasn't a situation that allowed for diplomacy or euphemism.
She's his mother, and he knows it, Roger said bluntly.
Whatever McEwen had been expecting, that wasn't it. And for an instant, Roger was gratified to see the man's face go absolutely blank with shock. Only for an instant, though. It was likely going to be a tricky bit of pastoral counselling at best.
You know what he is, Roger said, taking the doctor by the arm again and pulling him toward a brocaded wing chair. Or rather, what we are.
Cognosco te?
I...
McEwen's voice died, though he opened and closed his mouth a few times, helplessly looking for words.
Aye, I know, Roger said soothingly. It's difficult. But you do know, don't you?
I... yes.
McEwen sat down abruptly. He breathed for a moment, blinked once or twice, and looked up at Roger.
His mother? His mother? I have it on good authority, Roger assured him.
A thought struck him, though.
You did know about her, didn't you? That she's one of us?
McEwen nodded.
She's never admitted it. Just laughed at me when I told her where I'd come from. And I didn't know for a long time. Not until I...
His lips clamped abruptly into a tight line.
I'm guessing you didn't have occasion to heal her of anything, Roger said, carefully. Does she, has it got anything to do with blue light, by chance?
He was trying hard to avoid the mental picture of Gillis and Dr. McEwen, naked and sweating, both bathed in a faint blue glow. The woman was his several times great-grandmother, whatever else you like to say about her. McEwen gave him a bleak look and shook his head.
Not exactly. She's a very fine herbalist and not bad at diagnosis, but she can't do that.
He twiddled his fingers briefly in illustration, and Roger felt a faint memory of the warmth when McEwen had touched his throat. The doctor sighed and rubbed a hand over his face.
No point in evasion, I suppose. I got her with child, and I could see is not quite the right word, but I can't think of a better one. I could see the moment when my seed reached her ovum, the fetus. It glowed inside her womb. I could sense it when I touched her.
A certain heat rose in Roger's face.
Forgive me for asking, but how do you know
that happened because she's what she is?
Might it not be the case with a normal woman?
McEwen smiled very bleakly at the word normal and shook his head.
I had two children by a woman in Edinburgh in my own time, he said quietly, and looked down at his feet. That was one of the reasons I didn't try to return.
Roger made a sound in his damaged throat that was meant to be regretful and compassionate, but whether his feelings or his larynx had got the better of him, it emerged as a rather stern, and McEwen's colour began to rise again.
I know, he said wretchedly. I don't seek to excuse it. Just as well, Roger thought. I'd like to see you try, you...
But recriminations would do no one any good just now, and he stifled whatever else he might have said on the subject, instead returning to Gillis.
You said you got her,
jerking his chin upward to where the sounds of footsteps and bumpings were audible overhead.
With child. Where is the child?
McEwen drew a long, trembling breath.
I said, she's a very fine herbalist. Jesus, Lord, Roger said. Did you know she meant to do it?
McEwen swallowed audibly but kept silent.
My God, Roger said. My God. I know it's not my place to judge you, but if it was man, you'd burn in hell.
And with that, he went downstairs and out into the streets of Cranesmuir, leaving the lot of them to their own devices. He'd made 16 circuits of the village square, it was a small square, before getting a precarious hold on his sense of outrage. He stood in front of the Duncan's front door, fists clenched, taking deep, deliberate breaths. He had to go back. You didn't walk away from people who were drowning, even if they'd jumped into a quagmire on purpose. And he didn't want to think what might happen if McEwen, left to himself, should be overcome by anguish or fury and rush in on the pair in the attic. He really didn't want to think what Buck, or God forbid Gillis, might do in that case. And the thought galvanized him. He didn't trouble knocking. Arthur Duncan was a procurator fiscal. His door was always open. The wee maid poked her head out of an inner door at the sound of his footsteps. But when she saw who he was, she drew it in again, doubtless thinking he'd just stepped out for something. He nearly sprinted up the stair, a guilty conscience now furnishing him with visions of Hector McEwen hanging from the small chandelier in the parlour, helpless feet kicking in the air. When he burst in, though, he found McEwen slumped forward in the wing chair, face buried in his hands. He didn't look up at Roger's entrance, and wouldn't raise his head, even when Roger shook him gently by the shoulder. "Come on, man," he said gruffly, then cleared his throat.
"You're still a doctor, aren't you? You're needed."
That made the man look up, startled. His face was mottled with emotion. Anger, shame, desolation, lust. Could lust be an emotion? Roger wondered briefly, but dismissed the consideration as academic at the moment. McEwen straightened his shoulders and rubbed both hands hard over his face, as though trying to erase the feeling so plainly displayed there.
"Who needs me?"
he said, and rose to his feet with a decent attempt at composure.
"I do,"
Roger said, and cleared his throat again with a noise like falling gravel. It felt like gravel, too. Strong emotion choked him, literally.
"Come outside, eh? I need air. So do you."
McEwen cast one last look up at the ceiling where the noises had now ceased, then firmed his lips, nodded, and, taking up his hat from the table, came along. Roger led the way out of the square and past the last house, then up a cow path, dodging heaps of manure, until they reached a dry-stained wall that they could sit upon. He sat down himself and gestured to McEwen, who sat obediently. The walk had lent the doctor some semblance of calm, and he turned at once to Roger and spread open his collar, this still flapping loose. Roger felt the ghost of Gillis Duncan's touch on his throat and shivered. But it was cold out, and McEwen took no notice. The doctor wrapped his fingers loosely around the scar and seemed to listen for a moment, head to one side. Then he pulled his hand back a little and felt delicately up higher with two probing fingers, then lower, a small frown of concentration on his face. And Roger felt it, the same odd sensation of light warmth. He'd been holding his breath under the doctor's touch, but at this realization he exhaled suddenly and freely. "Jesus," he said, and put his own hand to his throat. The word had come freely, too.
"It's better?"
McEwen was looking at him intently, his earlier upset subsumed in professional concern.
"It is."
The scar was still bumpy under his fingers, but something had changed. He cleared his throat experimentally. A little pain, a little blockage, but noticeably better. He lowered his hand and stared at McEwen.
"Thank you.
What the bloody hell did you do?" The tension that had been twanging through McEwen since Roger and Buck had entered the Duncan's house finally eased, just as the tightness in Roger's throat had.
I don't know that I can tell you with any great precision, he said apologetically. It's just that I know what a sound larynx should feel like, and I can tell what yours feels like, and...
He shrugged a little, helpless.
I put my fingers there and envision the way it should be.
He touched Roger's throat gently again, exploring.
I can tell that it's very slightly better now, but there is a good deal of damage. I can't say whether it would ever be completely healed. In all truth, I doubt it. But if I were to repeat the treatment, it seems to need some time between treatments, no doubt for the tissue to heal, just as an external wound would. So far as I can tell, the optimum time between treatments of a serious injury is about a month. Gilles...
And here his face twitched violently. He had forgotten.
He mastered himself with an effort, though, and went on. Gilles thinks that the process may be affected by the phase of the moon, but she is...
A witch, Roger finished for him.
The look of unhappiness had returned to McEwen's face, and he lowered his head to hide it.
Perhaps, he said softly. Surely she is an unusual woman. And a good thing for the human race that there aren't more like her, Roger said,
but then checked himself. If he could pray for Jack Randall's immortal soul, he couldn't do less for his own great-grandmother, homicidal maniac or not. But the immediate problem was to try to extract the hapless soul before him from her clutches, before she could destroy Hector McEwen utterly.
Dr. McEwen. Hector,
he said softly, and laid a hand on the doctor's arm.
You need to go right away from this place, and from her. She won't merely bring you great unhappiness, or imperil your soul. She may well kill you.
A look of surprise momentarily displaced the unhappiness in McEwen's eyes. He looked aside, pursed his mouth, and glanced back at Roger, sidelong, as though afraid to look at him too directly.
"Surely you exaggerate," he said.
But the words had no force. McEwen's own Adam's apple bobbed visibly as he swallowed. Roger drew a deep, unconstricted breath and felt the cold, damp air fresh in his chest.
"No," he said gently. "I don't. Think about it, aye. And pray, if you can. There is mercy, aye. And forgiveness."
McEwen sighed too, but not with any sense of freedom in it. He cast his eyes down, fixed them on the muddy lane and the rain-dancing puddles in the low spots.
"I cannot," he said,
his voice low and hopeless.
"I've tried. I can't."
Roger's hand was still on McEwen's arm. He squeezed hard and said,
"Then I'll pray for you." "And for her,"
he added, hoping no reluctance showed in his voice.
"Thank you, sir," the doctor said. "I value that extremely."
But his eyes had lifted and turned as though he had no power over them, toward Cranesmuir and its smoking chimneys. And Roger knew there was no hope. He walked back to Cranesmuir and waited in the square till the door of the Duncan's house opened and Buck emerged. The man looked mildly surprised, but not displeased, to see Roger, and nodded at him, but didn't speak. They walked together to an ordinary, where they got a room and went upstairs to refresh themselves before supper. The ordinary didn't run to a bath, but hot water, soap, razor and towels went some way to restore them to a decent state of cleanliness. Buck hadn't spoken a word more than necessary, but he had an odd expression, half pleased and half ashamed, and kept darting sidelong glances at Roger, as though unsure whether to say something, but rather wanting to. Roger poured a cup of water from the ewer, drank half of it, and set the cup down with an air of resignation.
"Tell me you didn't," he said finally. "Please."
Buck shot him a quick glance, looking both shocked at the words and slightly amused.
No, he said, after a pause long enough to knot Roger's belly. No, I didn't. I'm no saying I couldn't have, though, he added. She wasn't unwilling.
Roger would have said he didn't want to know, but he wasn't quite able to deceive himself.
You tried?
Buck nodded, then picked up the cup of water and dashed the remnants into his own face, shaking them off with a woof of breath.
I kissed her, he said. Put my hand on her breast.
Roger had seen the upper slopes of those breasts as they swelled above her deep green woolen bodice, round and white as snowdrops, but a lot bigger. By a considerable force of will, he kept himself from asking,
And what happened then?
He didn't have to, though. Buck was obviously reliving the experience and wanted nothing more than to talk about it.
She put her hand on mine, but she didn't pull my hand away. Not at first. She went on kissing me.
He broke off and looked at Roger, one brow raised.
Have you kissed many women?
I haven't kept count,
Roger said with a slight edge.
Have you?
Four, besides her,
Buck said contemplatively. He shook his head.
That was different.
I'd expect it would be. Kissing your mother, I mean.
Not that kind of different.
Buck touched his lips with two fingers, lightly as a girl might.
The other kind.
Or maybe I didn't mean that quite. I kissed a whore once, and it wasn't like that at all.
He patted his lips absently for a moment, then realized what he was doing and drew his hand away, looking momentarily embarrassed.
Ever gone with a whore?
I have not,
Roger said, trying not to sound censorious, but not managing all that well. Buck shrugged, dismissing it.
Well, so. She kept my hand on her breast while she took her time about kissing me. But then...
He paused, blushing, and Roger drew himself up. Buck, blushing?
What then?
He asked, unable to refrain.
Well, she drew it down, Ken, over her body, very slow, and still kissing me. And, well, I must have heard her skirts rustle, mustn't I? But I wasn't paying attention, because when she took my hand and put it on her, lady part, I thought I'd pass out from the shock.
Her, was she it, I mean, naked?
Bare as an egg and just as bald, too,
Buck assured him.
Have you ever heard of such a thing?
I have, aye.
Buck stared at him, green eyes wide.
You mean your wife? I bloody don't,
Roger snapped.
Don't you dare speak of Brianna and Amadan, or I'll gee you your head and your hands to play with.
You and who else?
Buck said automatically, but waved a hand to calm Roger.
Why did you not tell me my mother was a whore?
I wouldn't tell you something like that, even if I knew it for a fact.
And I didn't,
Roger said. Buck looked at him for a moment in silence, eyes direct.
You'll never make a decent minister, he said at last, if you can't be honest.
The words were said objectively, without heat, and stung the more on that account, being true. Roger breathed in hard through his nose and out again.
All right,
he said, and told Buck everything he knew, or thought he knew, concerning Gillian Edgars, alias Gilles Duncan.
Jesus, God,
Buck said, blinking.
Aye,
Roger said shortly. Buck's description of his encounter with his mother had given Roger a vividly disturbing image of Brianna, and he hadn't been able to dismiss it. He hungered for her, and as a result was acutely aware of Buck's lingering images of Gilles. He saw the man's hand absently cup itself, fingers drawing in slowly, as though he were guddling.
Christ, he could smell her on Buck's flesh,
pungent and taunting.
"So now you've met her," Roger said abruptly, looking away. "And now you ken what she is. Is that enough, do you think?"
He was careful to make the question no more than a question, and Buck nodded, but not in answer, more as though he were having an internal conversation. With himself or with Gillis, Roger didn't know.
"My father," Buck said thoughtfully, without actually answering. "From what he said when we met him at the McLaren's Croft, I thought he maybe didn't ken her yet. But he was interested, you could tell that."
He looked suddenly at Roger, a thought having struck him.
"Do you think it was meeting us that made him, will make him," he corrected with a grimace, "go and find her?"
He glanced down, then back up at Roger.
"Would I not exist if we hadn't come to find your wee lad, I mean?"
Roger felt the usual sense of startled creepiness at realizations of this sort, something like having cold fingers suddenly laid against the small of his back.
"Maybe so," he said, "but I doubt you'll ever know that. Not for sure."
He was glad enough to leave the subject of Gillis Duncan, though Buck's other parent was probably no less dangerous.
"Do you think you need to speak with Dougal Mackenzie?" Roger asked carefully. He didn't want to go anywhere near Castle Leoch or the Mackenzies,
but Buck had a right to do it if he wanted. And Roger himself had an obligation, two of them, as kin and as priest, to help him if he did. And however such a conversation might work out, he doubted very much that it would be as disconcerting as the meeting with Gillis.
"As for dangerous, though..." "I don't know," Buck said softly, as though talking to himself. "I dinna ken what I'd say to the man, to either of them."
That alarmed Roger, who sat up straight.
"You don't mean you'd go back to her? To your mother?"
Buck's mouth curled up on one side.
"Well, we really didna say much to each other," he pointed out. "Neither did I," Roger said shortly, "to my father."
Buck made an indeterminate noise in his throat, and they fell silent, listening to the growing drum of rain on the slates of the roof. The tiny fire dwindled under the rain coming down the chimney and went out, leaving no more than the faint smell of warmth. And after a bit, Roger wrapped himself up in his cloak and curled up on one side of the bed, waiting for his body to warm enough for sleep to come. The air through the cracked window was sharp with cold and the tingling smell of wet bracken and pine bark. No place smelled like the Highlands, and Roger found his heart eased by its harsh perfume. He was nearly asleep when Buck's voice came softly to him through the dark.
"I'm glad you got to say it, though."
Chapter 105.
"No, a very good person."
Roger had insisted on camping outside the town, thinking it better to get Buck as far away from Gillis Duncan as was feasible. For once it wasn't raining, and they'd managed to gather enough in the way of pine twigs for a decent wood fire. Pine would usually burn, even if damp, because of the resin.
"I'm no a very good person."
The words were quiet and took a moment to register. Roger looked up to see Buck slumped on his rock, a long stick in his hand, poking at the fire in a desultory fashion. Roger rubbed a hand along his jaw. He felt tired, discouraged, and in no mood for more pastoral counselling.
"I've met worse," he said after a pause.
It sounded unconvincing. Buck looked at him from under the fringe of blonde hair.
"I wasn't looking for contradiction or consolation," he said dryly. "It was a statement of fact. Call it a preface, if you like." "All right."
Roger stretched, yawning, then settled himself.
"A preface to what? An apology?"
He saw the question on his ancestor's face and, irritated, touched his throat.
"For this?" "Ah, that.
Buck rocked back a little and pursed his lips, eyes fixed on the scar.
"Aye, that," Roger snapped, irritation flaring suddenly into anger. "Do you have any notion what it was you took from me, you bastard?"
"Maybe a bit."
Buck resumed poking at the fire, waiting till the end of his stick caught, then stubbing it out again in the dirt. He fell silent then, and for a bit there was no sound but the rattle of wind through the dry bracken.
"A ghost walking by,"
Roger thought, watching the brown fronds within the circle of firelight stir and then fall still.
"I don't say it as excuse, mind," Buck said at last, eyes still fixed on the fire. "But there's the matter of intent. I didn't mean to get you hanged."
Roger made a low, vicious noise in response to this. It hurt. He was damned tired of it hurting to speak or sing or even grunt.
"Bugger off," he said abruptly, standing up. "Just bugger off. I don't want to look at you."
Buck gave him a long look, as though debating whether to say something, but then shrugged, got up, and disappeared. He was back within 5 minutes, though, and sat down with the air of someone who had something to say.
"Fine," Roger thought. "Get on with it."
"Did it not occur to the two of you, while reading those letters, that there's another way for the past to speak to the future?"
"Well, of course," Roger said, impatient.
He stabbed his dirk into one of the turnips to test it. Still hard as a rock.
"I thought of all sorts of things. Diaries left under stones, newspaper notices."
He grimaced at that one.
"And a number of less useful notions. But most of those options were either too unsure or too risky. That's why we arranged to use the banks, but..."
He trailed off. Buck was looking smugly superior.
"And I suppose you've thought of something better," Roger said.
"Why, man, it's right under your nose."
With a smirk, Buck bent to test his own turnip, and evidently finding the results acceptable, lifted it out of the ashes on the point of his dirk.
"If you think I'm going to ask you..."
"Beyond that," Buck said, blowing on the hot turnip between phrases. "Beyond that, it's the only way for the future to speak to the past."
He gave Roger a straight, hard look, and Roger felt as though he'd been stabbed with a screwdriver.
"What, you?" he blurted. "You mean you..."
Buck nodded, eyes casually on his smoking turnip.
"Can't be you, can it?"
He looked up suddenly, green eyes catching the firelight.
"You won't go. You wouldn't trust me to keep looking. I..."
The words caught in Roger's throat, but he was well aware that they showed in his face. Buck's own face twisted in a lopsided smile.
"I would keep looking," he said, "but I see how you'd not believe me." "It's not that," Roger said, clearing his throat. "It's only I can't leave while Jem might be here. Not when I don't know for sure that I could come back if I left, and he wasn't at the other end."
He made a helpless gesture.
"Go. I know I was maybe abandoning him forever."
Buck nodded, looking down. Roger saw the other man's throat move too, and was struck by a pang of realization.
"You're Jem," Roger said softly. "You do know where he is, at least. When, I mean."
The question was clear. If Buck was willing to risk the stones again, why would he not do it in search of his own family, rather than to carry a message to Bree?
"You're all mine, aren't you?" Buck said gruffly. "My blood. My sons."
Despite everything, Roger was moved by that. A little. He coughed, and it didn't hurt.
"Even so," he said.
He gave Buck a direct look.
"Why, you ken it might do for you. It might have done this last time if McEwen hadn't been there."
Mm-hmm.